When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello and welcome back to the New Books in Indian Religions podcast, a podcast channel here on the New Books Network. I'm your host, Dr. Raj Balkaran, and today I get the pleasure of welcoming back to the podcast Dr. Caleb Simmons, who is Professor of Religious Studies at the University of Arizona. He's been on before to talk about two of his monographs, Devotional Sovereignty, Singing the Goddess into Place, and a fascinating edited volume that I contributed to myself, Nine Nights of the Goddess. But today, above and beyond his scholarship, we're going to speak with Caleb about his role as the executive director of an entity called U Arizona Online. And of course, that will probably lead into some interesting and timely discussion. Caleb, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks for having me, Raj. Always happy to be on with you.
Yes, it's always like, you know, old friends meeting at random conferences and random podcasts somehow. your profession is so, in so many ways, simpatico and an alternate universe of my own, insofar as not only do you study the Hindu goddess, you're also into administration and all in education. Look at that. It's like, you know, I'm having a bit of a man crush on your career. It's an alternate version of what I'm doing, I suppose. But you're probably aware that I do online education as well, and I run an online school, et cetera, et cetera. But this entity called U Arizona Online, tell us a bit about it. How long has it been in existence?
Arizona Online launched in 2015 as the online campus for the University of Arizona, so offering the same courses taught by the same faculty that we have on main campus, just now offering it in an online modality. So since 2015, we've invested in onboarding programs, building out student support mechanisms, and of course, thereby growing enrollment. So now at this point, as of yesterday, we have over 9,100 students, which makes up roughly one fifth of the population of the University of Arizona. And so we've grown in leaps and bounds, and have over 160 degree and certificate programs, both at the undergraduate and the graduate level.
Fantastic. I mean, this is exciting. I mean, I think I've touched on this a number of times in previous podcasts here and there, that it seems to me that online education is, nothing can replace in-person contact, retreats, et cetera, et cetera. Nevertheless, I think gone are the days, thanks to COVID, where folks think of online education as somehow the fast food of the pedagogy world. And I think people have had direct experiences transformative learning, impactful learning that just happens to be through the online medium. Yeah. Would you say, in your personal experience, you've noticed, as a professor at university and as well leading up to directing this institution, what are your observations about online education? What's your perspective?
Yeah, I think your point about COVID is, pretty apropos, because what COVID did for so many social and economic issues is it didn't necessarily, cause a lot. It did cause some, obviously, but it... a light was shone onto pre-existing issues. And one thing that it did in higher education in particular is it highlighted the fact that gone are the days of the, quote unquote, traditional student, those that go to a residential college or university 4 years, don't work, have no outside obligations. And in fact, when you look at the data, I mean, it's been quite some time that hasn't been the majority of students. And now the vast majority, almost three out of every four students that attend any higher education institution, are post-traditional or non-traditional students, meaning that they have some sort of work or care obligation They are independent for financial purposes. They haven't followed a traditional high school to higher education route. And these were students that we were not serving properly. And then through the transition to virtual education, digital education, online education through the pandemic, what we realized is that we do have mechanisms to serve these students better. And that once we made the offering available, it wasn't just, you know, new students who were we were finding, but also our current students needed that flexibility to be able to go to school and live their lives and live them both to the fullest. And so now we see is statistics coming from, you know, sort of every large organization for online and distance education, confirming that over half of all students, even those at residential universities and colleges, want at least partial online learning. And so the market demand from students is just flowering. And it's because we haven't been serving the actual needs of our students as we should be.
Is it fair to say that what you're doing at Arizona is a little bit ahead of the curve institutionally across universities?
Yeah, you know, it's always a matter of perspective. Because in Arizona, one thing that's great about the state is that we've had a lot of interest in online education. Going back to, you know, University of Phoenix, ASU Online, Grand Canyon University, who offers the majority of their programs online. So it's been something that's kind of in the water in Arizona, maybe. And so University of Arizona, we took a different approach than some of our other colleagues here, where we really wanted to focus on our identity as a Research One AAU institution and ensuring that we recreate the rigor of our in-person main campus programs, but in an online modality. So rethinking our pedagogy from the ground up and our andragogy also, because we're really serving a lot of adult learners, you know, building it from the ground up to maintain that rigor and rethink how do you teach with rigor, with the same fullness in an online modality. So not saying that, you know, it's the same, because that's the wrong way to look at it, but it is another option that can be done just as well. And it stands on its own merits.
Yeah, it's another path up the mountain, right? It's another means of arriving at whatever the learning objectives are. And this is a really, really important point. I have to tell you, I mean, I'm very much, if you can believe it, an old-fashioned face-to-face handshake, wheeling and dealing kind of guy. And I don't consume very much online content at all. Don't spend a whole lot of time on social media. And yet, ironically, I have a career producing a ton of it with podcasts, with online courses. I have an online school. And to me, it's just that the medium is online, but the way of being is, it's not so, so different from teaching in front of a classroom, although there has to be some alterations, I suppose, some modifications. But I went from a real cynic about the efficacy of online education. And because I, in addition to, you know, I've really benefited from face-to-face deep transmissions with teachers. And I went from a cynic to having a thriving career teaching people online. It's astonishing the kinds of impact and transformations people can enjoy through the online medium. Could you say a little bit about the pedagogy piece and sort of what you have learned, share a bit more about that journey of teaching online versus in person?
My personal journey for online was a circuitous one, but one that the more I taught and the more I learned, the more I realized that the modality of online provided unique tools for my subject matter specifically as a scholar of South Asia. I mean, I've always taught at large state public institutions, starting at the University of Florida as a graduate student, then the University of Mississippi, and now the University of Arizona. And believe it or not, there's not a lot of demand for people to major in South Asian religions. However, it was a subject that people were interested in. So I was teaching general education courses, and I was finding that I was hitting a roadblock with a lot of my students, because one of my first courses that I taught was Hindu mythology. I know it's a subject near and dear to both of our hearts.
I've heard a thing or two about Hindu myths.
Yeah. So it wound up being this instance where, you know, I'm excited about the subject. The students are excited about the subject, but there's a language barrier, a literal language barrier with the Sanskrit words, pronunciation, and the length of the words. So for them to be able to hear, recognize, connect it to what they were reading was really difficult. The first time I ever did an asynchronous online course, I realized immediately when our accessibility team put in captions, and of course I had to go through and clear them up and like change some of the spellings for things to make them align with the reading materials, what I noticed is that students' grades were getting better. Their actual achievement of the learning was better because they could pause it, they could read along, they could make those associations a way that was very difficult in lecture. I mean, I could have names on PowerPoints, but you know, when you get excited and in the mode and you sort of switch over into the theatrics of telling a story and you switch between epithets, you know, Shiva, Maheshwara, like in that moment, you're excited because you're a subject matter expert, but it's whizzing past the students in those moments when you're most dynamic. And online lecture allows you to continue that dynamic presentation. And then through tools like captioning, not only does it make it more accessible for all students, with no matter what their level of abilities, now it's also making it easier for them to learn the subject. And so now those baseline hurdles of kind of data, we can overcome that and we can actually get to the meat of the discussion once we have all those data points aligned. So for my personal subject, teaching primarily Hinduism, the online modality actually allowed me to be a better teacher and for my students to be more successful learners.
I really like the way that you framed that. I mean, of course, you know, the key idea, a driving force, I think, in both of our careers and the podcast, et cetera, is accessibility and people interested in the conversation, and they just need a way in, you know, a way to keep up with what's going on. It's not a question of intelligence. It's just a question of familiarity and background. And when you say that, what comes up to my mind is this instinct. These days, I do a fair, almost all continue. I do some credit teaching once or twice a year. I'll do an online contract. I love corrupting the youth, as they say. Don't get any ideas, folks. That's a Socrates reference, anyhow. Mostly continuing studies. And these days, a lot of people who are in the yoga circuit, the yoga teacher training. Facilities where they're looking for Indian philosophy, they're looking for mythology, like the new book stories behind the poses, and I often say, like, look, you're going to get more slides and links that you know what to do with it at the end of this presentation. Just be with me, be in the story, you know, give yourself the permission to just absorb what you can in the moment. You'll take a lot away, especially with the storytelling pieces, and I'll give you all the information you need. And like 30,000 foot view, we're in the information age. We have more information and access information than we know what to do with. And it's just a question of, I think, curation and digestion. And so I like the way you framed that. It's a question of just, you know, giving them the information that they need, that they can consume at their pace rather than at the pace that you're dishing it out in class. Have you always been interested in online education?
You know, when I was working on my PhD at University of Florida with Professor Vasudha Narayanan, she approached me one day with an interesting opportunity. The provost was trying to get applications for online courses. And this was before UF Online even launched. And I had some teaching experience. I had some experience with, you know, websites. And so it wound up actually being just at the right place, the right time. But when I got into it, part of the, you know, building the grant proposal was learning more about online pedagogy and its tools. And as soon as I was successful in the grant, as soon as I was able to teach it, I saw the benefits for my subject matter. And so it wound up being one of those things that I, you know, like any other professional development that I had needed to work on and needed to get better. But the better I got, the more I saw that it was rewarding professionally for myself, also for my students. And so it really opened it up. And then when I started to really grow as an educator and think about the ideas of access writ large, so thinking about accommodations for students that need things, the asynchronous online modality is squishy in a way that you can accommodate a lot more people, but also thinking about our mission as educators, we've developed expertise, and as educators, it is almost our responsibility to share that expertise with whomever needs it. And we limit ourselves if we only think in person. I mean, I think guest lectures are a key example of this that has changed, that you had to be in a specific time and place, and everyone else's time and place had to align. So like, you really had to like have all of these alignments to have people who want to learn be able to access it. Now with the, having Zooms, being able to record, have asynchronous, the ambitious learners can have access to the information and our expertise whenever. And it really, if we think about it as a mission-driven profession of education, like this aligns closely with what I believe we should be doing, which is providing access to people who want to learn about our topic. And it shouldn't matter that they're, for me, that they're in Tucson on Tuesday at 11 a.m. to be able to be there for me. And it's sort of reversing the, instead of they need to meet us where we are, we can actually meet them where they are.
Well, that's the name of the game, isn't it? The dissemination of knowledge, certainly the production of knowledge, but in some sense, absent the dissemination thereof, it serves one person.
Oh, exactly.
The person finding it out. And it's interesting. The world has changed. I found myself strangely teaching online on Zoom in 2017. And so when the pandemic hit, I just got busier. And and it's so, the world is so interesting in the last, say, couple of months. I'll do a YDT in Norway. I'll do a guest lecture at a university in New York. I'll do, you name it, a lecture on the west coast of Canada, et cetera, all from here where we're speaking now on Zoom. And it's, the world really is changing in terms of access to information and speakers. And it's brilliant. I mean, I literally had Corin Dempsey on the podcast. I mean, for anybody who does Hindu goddess stuff, like the goddess lives upstate New York. I mean, iconic, yeah. Iconic, right? And we're just emailing after the podcast. Hey, would you like to speak to my Hinduism women and goddesses class? And I'm like, sure. All I need is a Zoom link. Carve out an hour in my schedule. It's like, it's a little bit unreal, but it's great.
And if we also think about that from like a sustainability front, as scholars of South Asia and of India, like there, we have also a responsibility to share our findings with the Indian community. And what it required before was a great amount of financial resources. It also required a lot of environmental resources with flights. And then again, we had limited populations when we got there. Now I can literally wake up a little bit early, Zoom in to, JNU or DU or University of Mysore or Calicut University, do a lecture, engage with students and historians, and then I can log off and I can come to work, right? And so the disruptions that this is able to allow in the way that we exchanged information globally has really been beneficial for everyone. And we're all growing through these interactions and becoming, honestly, in my opinion, more ethical scholars the more we engage in this type of online activity.
That's fascinating. I'm just remembering as, you forget all the threads, right? I remember just a couple of years ago, I had a bit more bandwidth. I teach at the OCHS's Continuing Studies Department, but I had a bit more bandwidth to do administration and organize some events for them. And we had an online weekend school. And I think you were one of the speakers, and we had scholars from everywhere. I can't even remember the topic for that one. It might've been the Hindu goddess, actually. And it's really cool. I mean, people can just hear expertise from scholars across the Americas and the UK, et cetera, et cetera. What do you see? What are perhaps some of the challenges that we're still working out with the whole online education thing?
Yeah, I mean, honestly, one of the biggest hurdles that I'm faced with and that I hear all the time is something I alluded to earlier, and that's the comparison of in-person and online, that people see that as an either or, that, you know, is it, excuse me, is it as good as being in class? And it's to choose this one or this one. And the real answer to that to me is for whom? For some people, in person is better because they have the means to be there. For other people that don't necessarily have the means to be there or have other obligations, online can be a better choice. And when you think about, you know, pedagogically what we're doing, if you try to replicate in person and online, you wind up being disingenuous and it doesn't resonate. But if you lean into the modality and use the tools that are available, you can produce something that stands on its own, has its rigor, has deep learning. And so overcoming that either or, which is rooted in a deeper concern of online is lesser than, that this is not as rigorous, this is not as important, this is what you do kind of on the side and you get by and you get your like fake degree, you get your fake credential. And, you know, being in the space now full time and traveling to conferences and myself taking online courses, it is absolutely not the case. Like I can point back to very bad classes I had in person. And I can certainly point to bad classes I've had online. I can also point to phenomenal classes in person and phenomenal classes online. And so it's, you know, it's the same issues that we have with instructional quality is also there in online. But in many respects, it is, you know, it is a different modality, but it is something that is at full rigor of requirements for accreditation and for everything else. And I'm willing to any day bet any of my programs against our main campus that we are producing students who are as knowledgeable, as satisfied as anybody else.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And in this particular case, I can chime in having taught maybe about 4 or 5 online credit courses and university courses. The students learned as much, if not more, as if I was actually present. And in certain cases, they were more engaged with, you know, the very, you know, watching, you know, we had class time and go watch Sita Sings the Blues and let's discuss, you know, or et cetera, et cetera. And this idea that the world associates online with social media, for example. So it's a space to hang out and connect, but the online medium is much, much, much more than that. And without question, it's a vibrant and thriving learning space. And that's been shown time and time again. And as I said, I went from a skeptic to a well-known online teacher in the field of Hindu studies, at least in the continuing studies world. And it's just bringing your people skills and your empathy and your pedagogical skills, and it's just adapting it to a different situation. I mean, above and beyond just even teaching, I do one-on-one sort of life guidance where people had massive breakthroughs where we're hundreds of miles apart, but the online, it's just a medium. It's just another medium of dissemination of communication. And in addition to the instruction, it opens up so much more enrichment in terms of video, audio, et cetera, et cetera. I got a taste of your sort of dynamism and flair as a teacher, because I think it was 2018-ish. I edited a teaching and teaching edition for Religious Studies News, the American Academy of Religions magazine. And I think you were one of the contributors, and you were, it was above and beyond just using storytelling, as many of us do, teaching tales. But you're really, maybe I'll put a link to that in the podcast notes along with everything else we're touching on, but transmedia balancing, I think, is what you were driving at even then. So it's fantastic. I'm sure folks, I'm sure students are really engaged and learn a lot in such courses. Now, as an administrator, above and beyond a teacher, does it fall on you at all to establish a culture or teach or train, or how, you know, what is the role in terms of helping other teachers make that journey to becoming effective online teachers?
Yeah, it's a, it's part of the job, actually winds up being a little smaller part of the job than what I had originally thought. It's a lot of spreadsheets and budgets, to be honest with you. But it comes into the discussion when we start talking about, the maintenance of rigor and how faculty workload is going to be established. Because in my mind, if someone is a good online teacher, even if it's asynchronous, the course can never be set it and forget it. Like, it takes effort, even if everything's pre-recorded, to give detailed grading feedback, to ensure that you're responding to student concerns, engaging them through announcements and whatnot. There's an equal level of time investment that needs to be put into each course. And so that winds up being a lot of the conversation with deans and department heads when we're talking about their online programs, because the big problem is how we run on a 7.5 week model, but the main campus is primarily a 15 or 16 week semester. So we're in two sessions. How do they divide a faculty member's workload between the main campus population and our online population? And the knee-jerk reaction, and I've had this as well, is how do I take 15 weeks of information and squeeze it down to 7.5 weeks? And so having that conversation winds up being one where we have to dive into the actual pedagogies of online teaching and the population which we're serving. Because again, the primary assumption is that these are like other students, our online students who are 18 to 22 right out of high school. The average age of Arizona Online is over 30 years old. The majority, I think, is somewhere in 70% of our students work full time. So rethinking exactly who these students are and how they take courses. So taking four courses over 16 weeks or 15 weeks and dividing that attention over that length of time between four subjects is less efficient than having two courses at a time that are constricted. And most research shows that the shorter time frame, somewhere between 5 and 7.5 weeks, is the ideal time frame for those learners who have all these other obligations to really be able to focus their attention. And most of our students are part-time, so really they're taking one course at a time, but completing two in a semester, as opposed to having to do two and juggle those ideas at once. So it's a reframing of many of our assumptions about what a university course ought to look like, and rethinking it, really having a student first approach and how we can help them achieve their learning goals given their circumstances, as opposed to just doing things the way they've been done.
Do you, or would you consider, you as in perhaps the organization or even personally, teaching pedagogy, how to teach online?
Yeah, so we're actually, my colleagues over at the Arizona University Center for Assessment, Teaching, and Technology have been working on a certificate program that they'll be running through our College of Education that's teaching online by design. And so it is really a series of courses that looks at sort of an instructional design perspective plus an instructor's perspective to be able to really think about how you build an effective online course. And so they're taking some of the best worlds of instructional designers and instructors and mixing them together for a holistic pedagogy about how we as instructors and instructional designers ought to be thinking about how our courses are built from the ground up to be online courses. So it's going to be pretty exciting. And we've talked about the possibility of developing that. It's going to be a graduate certificate at this point into a full master's program, so people can get a master's in it. So it's a really innovative project. And I'm happy that my colleagues at UCAT, is what we call that center, have went through the practice of building out the curriculum.
Fascinating. Regarding the programs that are on offer through the school, are the programs, are they hybrid insofar as there are certain courses in person and online, or are there programs where they're completely online, the requirements?
Yes, so our online campus is 100% online, 100% asynchronous, primarily 7.5 week, even though we do, through the pandemic, we made some exceptions. And so there's some 15-week programs, but we focus on the asynchronous modality because of our student population and who we're targeting. And those are, you know, working adults who have, you know, some of them have child care obligations, elder care obligations, where they can really, we can be available as they need and as we can accommodate. So that's been our primary focus. We also offer asynchronous through other units, through other units of the university, like our distance and our continuing education branches. But our campus in particular is focused on asynchronous, which is also where my strengths lie. So we're in alignment.
What do you most enjoy about this work or this enterprise?
All right. I mean, this is my favorite question because I get really excited about it, because I do believe that, you know, it is a place in higher education where I can make a difference. You know, I can teach my course, and I had some large courses. I mean, one time a course had 1300 students. So it's a pretty good reach, and I can make an impact. But even at that largest of one of my gen eds, you know, every day here in this job, I'm affecting almost 10,000 students. I can help push policies forward to make higher education more inclusive, more diverse, more accessible, more equitable, more just. And by having that ability and being in the room when some of those decisions are being made, I can walk away every day, no matter how frustrating they are. And there's tons of frustrating days. I can walk away knowing that, like, I'm, and this sounds a little cheesy, but like fighting the good fight, like trying to work to make higher education better.
Yeah, fantastic. I've noticed in self and others, and, you know, theoretically, I know Sanskrit narrative or religion, but I think really what I love to know the best is actually human beings. And, you know, many of us are lucky to have a job, and some of us are very lucky to have a career. And some of us are extraordinarily lucky to have a mission that's monetized, whether traditionally or entrepreneurially, and that mission drives you. You get up and you're like, you know, I'm in Dharma, you know, to use an Indic expression, like I'm doing what I'm here to do, you know, whether defined by purpose or duty or some combination. And this is what I'm here to do. I mean, in my particular case, it's, you know, I'm here to teach. I'm here to disseminate knowledge and transform a piece of the educational world, or as a scholar, to transform a piece of the interpretation of narrative, etc. Blah, blah, blah. Who cares? The point is, being driven by what you're passionate about, then all of the nonsense attached to any job, particularly a bureaucratic job, is worth it. And the fact that you're impacting other human beings, I mean, when someone such as probably the people on this podcast right now are gifted with empathy, it makes all the difference to know that you've made that difference in the lives of other people. So it's amazing that you're doing this work. Let's see, maybe I'll ask you one more question and then we'll wrap up. Do you feel that in your perspective, and of course your sample size of one, that what is being done at the University of Arizona online ish, generally 30,000 foot view, pan out from Arizona, maybe pan out even from America, pan out. Do you think that universities in general, that this should be sort of a cornerstone of the university experience in these times?
Yeah, I mean, without a doubt. I mean, what we're learning, the more data that's being garnered through different surveys for different organizations at all levels, not just those focusing on distance and online education, are showing that there is demand from students for online courses, that this suits their needs. It's the modality with which they're familiar. And unless universities really start to take it seriously, they're going to miss the boat for what the future is. Like, get ahead of it now while it's, you know, sort of between 50 and 75%, because soon it's going to be the expectation that, you know, every program is fluid in its modality. And in fact, the Chloe 8 report just came out a couple of weeks ago, and it was subtitled. And I apologize to the the people over at Quality Matters for forgetting the subtitle, but it was about the multimodality future of higher education, that if you look at the data, people are expecting this to be the future, that when someone goes to a residential college, that a great percentage of their courses will still be online and there'll be a mixture of in-person and online. So really, you've got to get ahead of it. And I know this is something that for a lot of our listeners are going to be, academics in the humanities. And if you look around the higher ed landscape, from different universities closing their doors on language programs, on literature programs, and in some cases, religion programs, that it's a problem that the humanities are facing. And I honestly don't think it's because there's a lack of desire. Here at the University of Arizona, our humanities program is growing leaps and bounds. And part of it is because we leaned into the online modality. So there's, if we meet students, they'll meet us. And we're also in the humanities, not to get preachy, but we tend to be a little old school. We tend to be like, we need paper books, we need in person. And, we're trying to hold back a river from flowing that's going to flow anyway. We're trying to dam it up. So I think we need to reevaluate why we have those prejudices against sort of some of the more burgeoning technologies, to really be able to rethink, how we can serve our students and how we can serve ourselves and our own interests by meeting the students where they are.
Yeah, it's so utterly fascinating and relevant. It's so interesting for me to watch your career from the outside and see these bizarre parallels. And it's bizarre enough that we have these research interests, as wonderful self-respecting men who study the Hindu goddess and love the Hindu goddess and want to understand,
maybe there's something about the goddess and online too.
The goddess lives online. Yeah, there we go.
Yeah. I know you just published an article. I saw the announcement come through about the different
mother of compassion,
personalities. Yeah, personalities of the goddess. And if you really think about that, those are modalities, right? Those are modalities by which people are able to, go to the goddess by, either wrath or power, mothering, compassion, these are different facets, ways to get to the same end. And that's really what online is offering to education as well. I am not going to say whether it's Bhukti or Mukti, but it is a different.
She doesn't choose. She doesn't. Bhukti, yeah. Mukti, Padayini. too nerdy a joke. But anyhow, but for those of you who are listening, clearly, without question, we're not. I mean, it's only. This podcast isn't about marketing anything to anybody. I mean, a fraction of the audience might even consider be eligible to take these courses. But why I've invited you, Caleb, is because of this conversation. Much of my processing is intuitive, and then I have to wait until evidence shows up for me to say it out loud to people who need the evidence. But I've said to my inner circle for a number of years, about at least four, maybe five, that the future of humanities lies in online, in-person, hybrid. I could just feel it in the core of my being. And now, you have the evidence for it. You have the model for it. It's happening. Me personally, I was and still am in many ways a technophobe, and I'm challenged with certain things. It was like pulling teeth trying to create a website. Like, I was literally in tears 5 years ago. It was just ridiculous because I spent all my life understanding emotions and spirituality and intellectual stuff, and I just couldn't do any of this more practical stuff. I think of R.T. Dond, who's a brilliant scholar and storyteller, and just I had to sit her down one day and spend a couple hours with her, just because it's such a challenge to get over the tech piece. But once she got over that hurdle, she has a thriving, fascinating podcast, the Mahabharata podcast. And I think this is, we're becoming the change that's needed. It's not innovation at the expense of or compromising tradition. That's innovation so as to extend tradition. This is our survival. This is our way. This is our, many vestiges of our guild will go the way of the dodo if we don't adapt and meet the needs of the students in the world. And that does not mean sacrificing rigor. It doesn't mean sacrifice. It doesn't mean sacrificing anything, actually. It means actually adding rather than taking away from. But, you know, I think we're both similar in that way. And I'm just fascinated that somehow we're both studying the goddess and really into administration and teaching and online teaching in particular. So here you go. I had this conversation. I did some talks at Colgate University last fall. They have a place called Chapel House. The same person who founded Harvard's Center for the Study of the World Religions funded Chapel House for more contemplative studies. And so I was doing some talks and who knows what. But and my colleague there invited me and said, you seem to be thriving, but are you on the job market? Like, are you looking for an academic job? And it was an open question. And I said, to be honest with you, I was on the job market for, I think, a year after I graduated. And then America went a little bit different in 2016. And I thought, let me wait that out. And I was astonished that I could produce and be connected and I was fine. And then by the time the election cycle was over, there was a pandemic. And then it's like, everyone's online anyways, I'm staying in Toronto, you know, why not? And then I said to her, this colleague, I said, look, to be honest with you, I'd love to be, I love undergrads. Yeah. If for the right fit, clearly there have been zero positions looking for scholars of Sanskrit narrative since I've been looking for that research bit, obviously. I would love to teach at a university. But I said to her, I said, it would be a little bit of a waste to just do that traditional job. It would have to be a university who would want to put me to work to run something. I literally said to her, like some kind of online teaching space or public facing or some kind of, you know, whatever. I said, these other pieces of the puzzle would have to be part of the professorial post for it to make sense for both of us. And hilariously, I'm like, oh yeah, something like that, what Caleb's doing. I don't want your job, I assure you. I'm happily self-employed. Don't want your job. I'm like, yeah, something like that. You know, just, you know, whether it's at the University of Toronto or somewhere in Canada, who knows where, but just sort of pushing the envelope forward on the online education for some respected institution to show that, it's not a question of pedigree versus online. It's a question of actually integrating these two worlds, I think. Is there anything else about anything at all, yourself, your students, the University of Arizona Online that you wanted to touch on before we close for today?
Yeah, I would like to talk about one other thing, and that is, you know, because really my personal and professional mission is about increasing access. And one thing that has been really fun about this job is that, you know, whenever you have some decision-making ability, you can also try some cool things. And so one thing that we recently launched as a pilot and have been kind of going around through the conference circuit for online talking about is rethinking study abroad. How could we translate a study abroad experience for students who have all of these barriers to being able to go on a traditional study abroad, from time, being able to get off work, leaving kids behind, leaving partners behind? Like, it's actually, you know, study abroad is a very niche market, the way it's constructed. So we were able to launch a pilot for a virtual reality study abroad, in which we sent a professor to Greece, and it's about the ancient Greek world, who would deliver in situ lectures, build out other components such as, you know, beekeeping, olive oil tastings, building out the other sensory experiences that you would have with study abroad. And so right now we're collecting data on how successful that is, but being able to really think of the things that are critical to the humanities teaching experience, and being able to take students places and have that cultural exchange, how can we replicate it? So, you know, is it going to be exactly replicable? No, but there's probably some other things we can do that you couldn't do in the space. A lot of the sites in Greece were not wheelchair accessible. So someone who was in a wheelchair would not ever be able to do it, never be able to see the sites from these vantage points. And now they're able to visit it virtually. So there's so many exciting possibilities with VR, AR. Let's not even talk about AI, because it deserves its own time. But it's a world of possibilities right now. And I think the humanities are well suited to grab a hold of that, because what we do is inherently interesting. And so we're able to, you know, capture some of that interest if we think in new and innovative ways.
Fascinating. Well, thank you for appearing on the podcast, and thank you in particular for becoming the change.
Yeah. Well, thank you for having me, and thank you for all that you do in the space as well. You're crushing it.
I'll see what I do what I can. For those listening, we've of course been speaking with Dr. Caleb Simmons, who's professor of religious studies at University of Arizona and executive director of UArizona Online. The links to his books and probably everything we mentioned in passing will be in the podcast notes. Until next time, keep well, keep listening, keep reading, keep thinking, and keep contemplating the future of online education. Take care.